From the Sky News Centre at 6, the parents of a man known as Jihadi Jack have been given suspended sentences after being found guilty at the Old Bailey of funding terrorism. John Letts and Sally Lane sent the Muslim convert more than £200, even though they'd reason to believe he'd joined Islamic State in Syria. Speaking through their solicitor, Tayyab Ali, they said they did what any parent would do.
We have not been convicted of funding terrorism. We have been convicted of sending money to our son where there were reasonable grounds to suspect the money might have been used for terrorist purposes. No one during our trial even suggested that the £223 that we actually managed to send to Jack was in fact used for terrorism.
A Greenpeace protester who was manhandled out of a black tie dinner by a Tory MP says she won't press charges. Mark Field has been suspended as a Foreign Office minister and has apologised. The man dubbed the Wimbledon Prowler has been jailed for 14 years after admitting a string of burglaries dating back to 2008. Astrid Kapaj took family heirlooms, designer handbags and large quantities of cash. The judge at Kingston Crown Court told the 43-year-old he terrified the whole community. Andy Durham is an inspector with the Serious Crime Squad and says Kapaj's home location came as a surprise.
Conventional policing, you look at local known burglars as part of your early elements of inquiry. We certainly weren't looking for a fish and chip shop manager from Greater Manchester.
President Trump says he aborted strikes on three Iranian targets last night to spare lives. He was minutes away from retaliating for the downing of an unmanned American drone. Pinewood Studios says it's taking the issue of a hidden camera found in women's toilets very seriously. A 49-year-old man's been arrested. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Steele.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's Bristol City Council's councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus. From the Lib Dems, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Boris Johnson accused by the former London Fire Service chief of showing utter contempt for survivors and families of the 7/7 victims, demanding they be shut out of any due legal process. Was he one of the main reasons there's still been no public inquiry into what really happened that day? Why we have to continue to ask on this programme why the Israeli's embassy had foreknowledge of what was supposed to be a surprise attack that morning? The evidence still hasn't been examined by the police or in court, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Also, apparently Trump restrained himself from declaring war on Iran yesterday after a US drone was shot down. Just 6,000 miles from home. No thought of going to the United Nations Security Council for a mandate, of course. Putin warns any act of war against Iran will get a response. A response, he adds, which will make Trump sad. And a US-Israeli war with Iran will be catastrophic, says Putin, as provocations against Iran continue. How long until the unthinkable happens? And the vaccines. We take a look at some of the reasons people, particularly young mums, don't trust them. Is there any substance to those claims? And the latest talk on measles by the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Are we allowed to hear what he has to say? Or is he taboo? Also, MH17, the Malaysian president, says there's zero evidence the Russians shot down his national airliner over the Ukraine in 2014. This week, the Dutch NATO inquiry begs to differ. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 22. It's quite warm at last. Sunny spells tomorrow, light rain and showers though on Sunday, and possible thunderstorms on Sunday. Next week, highs around 28, very hot, but not so much sun. Sunny spells, but thundery downpours too. Next weekend, that's the 29th and 30th of June, highs around 20 Celsius, sunshine and light showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello there.
Now, one of the big bits of news this week, which we've got, I would call simply disinformation about, is the eviction of the Bear Pit. Everyone's saying it's because of antisocial behaviour down there, but really there's only three people living down there, and none of those were involved in the spice dealing which was going on. And I wonder, I mean, is it okay for the police to just leave spice dealers to continue dealing spice and then use the whole situation as an excuse to cordon the place off, shut the place down?
There's been a long time that area of Bristol has been not a very welcoming place, despite all the voluntary organisations that have been trying to make a real go of it. And some of them now feel they're being kicked out because of the pressure from people down there. There seems to be a group of people that think it's their land. It's a no-go area.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is, yeah, well, what I'm saying is there are homeless people living there, but there's a completely separate situation with the spice dealers. For example, spice dealers occupied the toilets, which the council closed about 4 or 5 years ago, and the police have just kind of allowed this spice dealing to continue without making arrests, and now that has been used as an excuse to get everybody out.
I don't think that is the excuse that's been used to get everybody out. I think it's been a long-term problem. And now, just recently, there's been pressure put on particular local groups who are trying to make a go of it down there. And that has just, I think the bubble has burst, and I think people have decided that something has to be done. I mean, it's got to be done in the right way. It's got to be done legally, it's got to be done sensitively, and it's got to be done in a way that people actually feel that that this is going to get back and going again in the future.
Well, yes. Martin, conflation, really, of the homeless and the spice dealers down there. And also, I spoke to Jude English yesterday, the Green Councillor for Ashley. She called it Stalag Bear Pit. Now, I don't know if you've been past there, but the whole thing has been cordoned off. All the subways locked off and everything, so no one can go through at all now.
That's right.
Well, I think when the People's Republic of Stokes Croft were given a kind of franchise to try and improve the situation down there, and I remember before the Civic Trust tried to push for it to be improved, you know, it's always been a place where, you know, homeless people, people with drug and alcohol problems have tended to congregate. And of course, but I don't think to my mind makes much sense for the voluntary groups to have been run off the park like that, because ultimately it then just reverts to being what it was before, which is an uncontrolled space where marginal elements hang out. And it's, you know, the marginal elements are not going to go away. When we had a debate down there, when we did what we used to call Speaker's Corner debates before it was handed over to PSRC, one of the people who got up to speak was from the Seventh-day Adventist Church up the road, and she'd been working with homeless people in the Bear Pit for years, and she said, I'm all in favour of improving things around here, but don't think by improving things you're going to get rid of the people who are here. You know, the idea that we can just get rid of, you know, marginal people and they can be made to disappear is simply wrong. You've got to create a space which they can continue to use, that others can use as well. And I think PSRC, to my mind, did quite a good job of that. And I'm afraid that, you know, we've now reverted to what it was before.
Well, I have to state an interest here, because we use a studio in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft every Wednesday to record the dialect programme. So you might consider me biased, but I do think that they made quite a good job of it with the art space. And possibly, Anthony, the combination of closing the toilets and removing the community groups that had been helping manage the Bear Pit at the, I think it was the end of last year, beginning of this year, seems to have created this power vacuum into which the spice dealers have moved.
Well, you're probably right, and there are other places where I think there are opportunities for that sort of behaviour to go on. The police's response to this is patchy, and that's, if it were consistent, that would be a lot better. I've got drug problems in my own ward, which seem to have been treated quite inconsistently. But I think there's a difference between people looking untidy in an area and people actually making it very difficult for others, voluntary and community groups, to try and make a real go of this and make it better. And I think that's what's gone up the scale a bit recently. And I think that's after several different attempts by this administration to impose different levels of enforcement. I think this is now the final fling, which is very sad because it is an important part of Bristol.
Well, at the moment, you can't go through there. It's Jude would call
completely cut off.
Stalag Bear Pit, she called it, which I found quite amusing. But I did actually speak last week to two of the people who were living down there, one in the bus and one in one of the containers on the right-hand side as you're going into town, and that's John and Mark. Martin, and here's a little clip from that now. That's going to be on our full interview on our dialect show next Tuesday at noon. Have you had some events down at the Bear Pit whilst you've been living there?
Yes, several, or almost regular. We have since almost the beginning of the year, and they all went down peacefully.
What sort of event?
Successfully.
What music? What sort
music,
of thing?
We have live bands playing, punk bands, and DJs in other occasions, and everybody seemed to enjoy it very much, and surprisingly peaceful. You know?
I mean, in a situation like that, you've got to have surely some kind of stewardship of it, you know, because I mean, there's lots and lots of time and effort goes in clubs and places like that where there's events into making sure that your audience is a safe space for them.
Yes.
How do you do that in somewhere like the Bear Pit?
I had just one time on the stage. I had to ask somebody to chill out, and it was only one occasion, but it didn't turn into a fight. And we didn't have to do anything, really. People just enjoying the music and forget about the aggression that usually comes up when people party.
it's almost like an amphitheatre, Martin, isn't it?
My plan would be to just turn it into a communal event space. It's already what it is anyway. Like, you know, this isn't like some revelation that people are going to be listening to, but like...
Well, what do you make of the events that already happened there? What's been going on?
Between the food that Johnny serves up, which is trying to do every day, because of a resource scarcity we can't do every day. Between that and then the protests that we've had down there, which is Extinction Rebellion and various other little protests going on, because it's so central and people can see it so easily, it's a very good space for people to get their message heard, you know. And then there's the music gigs. We've had live bands and we had DJs and MCs and rappers and stuff like that. We've had really big names down there that, to be honest with you, I can't remember because I'm not a massive fan of MCs and rappers and stuff, so like I wouldn't be able to tell you. There's a mate of mine who knows these people, as in is like, oh my god, that person played in the Bear Pit, I can't believe you got that person to play in the Bear Pit. Because they all want to play in the Bear Pit, you know. And we've had complaints from the hotels. We have had complaints from the hotel.
So what are you up till 2 or 3 in the morning?
No, we're about 12:30, which is less than the nightclubs that have bigger sound systems than us. And actually, literally, like, even though I am, 2/3 of a mile away from Blue Mountain in the Bear Pit, right? It still vibrates my entire 5 tons of steel container, yeah? Right, it still vibrates that like it's right next to the thing. So I don't know what they're complaining about noise from us. But the other thing is, we've had complaints from the hotels, and only the hotels and managers and stuff like that. But we haven't had any complaints from the people who stay in the hotels. In fact, the exact opposite.
Well, you'll probably find the people in the rooms are phoning reception saying, can you do something about this noise?
No. We had one guy come down in his underpants and say, oh my God, I can't believe I got a rave, a hotel room, and a mad night for 68 quid because I stayed in the Premier Inn on this night. We had a man and his wife and his 3 kids come down, you know, in the robes and stuff from the hotel. You know, we've had tourists from the Holiday Inn, and there's Premier Inn, and there's the Hampton, and then there's the student accommodation up behind us, and then there's various residences in front of us going up Stokes Cross and stuff, and everybody seems to like it.
Well, maybe some of those guests who didn't like it didn't make complaints, who was trying to stay at the Premier Inn and trying to sleep. But, I mean, they're switching the sound system off at 12:30, Martin. Sounds like, I mean, the sort of stuff you were doing there with, what was it, the Speaker's Corner thing. Well, it's a natural place to be doing it.
It was a one-off event, I mean, and it was actually, we did it in cooperation with the Civic Trust because they were trying to build the place up, you know. And you know, we had a debate, including some of the homeless people that were down there, and people working with the homeless people, and just random people who came by. And out of that came the whole idea to try and, you know, upgrade the place and bring in People's Republic of Soaps Cross and so on. I think there's always going to be tension around these kind of spaces. The question is, can it be managed? And, you know, can we, you know, sealing the whole thing off seems like an admission of defeat, frankly. I mean, if you're going to do that, what's the point? You know, it's basically, you know, we've got to keep trying to make it a place that everybody can use.
The council have got long-term plans for it, something called The Circle, apparently, which is going to be some kind of retail area as well as the whole place being redone.
Well, I mean, that's what you might call boosterism. I mean, and the woman who came down from the Seventh-day Adventist Church had been going down there every night for years, and she made a very powerful case that, you know, you can't improve the area if you must, but don't presume that you're going to exclude the people who've always used it, because they've got as much right to be there as anybody else. Only as much right. They can't exclude others. But to say that they've all got to go and we're going to turn it into a retail park for tourists, well, that's just wrong, isn't it?
The fact was, Anthony, it had degraded into a place which was quite hostile for people to walk through, for some certain people. I mean, some people probably wouldn't mind, but others would think, oh, I don't really want to go down here anymore. But that kind of process was precipitated by the council, in the form of Marvin and Asher Craig, removing People's Republic of Stokes Croft from the area. Anyway, what are your thoughts? Have you got a vision for the place yourself? What would you like to see happen there?
Well, a great deal of money was spent on trying to get people across the road on the surface some time ago. There are still people using those underpasses. We all know that underpasses are places where, you know, there is a lot of antisocial behaviour. They encourage it. But it's not just, you're referring to the fact that people are turfing off the People's Republic. There's been several groups who've made very, very big efforts
Bear Pit Improvement Group, which was a coalition of local groups, including People's Republic.
That was one of them, yeah.
Anyhow, on to the next local story, which was interesting to see on Channel 4 News last night, which is diesel cars. Now, Anthony, just before we were coming on, you were saying that you bought a diesel car originally because you thought that these were supposed to be better for the environment.
10 years ago, yes, I bought a diesel car because I did all of the research, and it was pretty clear that we should be trying to minimise the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, and that would be a good thing to do. That was before we were talking about NOx, of course.
Okay, so the headline is Bristol could ban diesel cars from city centre for 8 hours a day under desperate an innovative plan, depending on which your point of view is.
Well, it's not very innovative, because there are radical ways that we could solve this.
I mean, someone's got to tackle this air pollution. Everyone's been having a go at Marvin for years. You've got to sort something out.
Well, that's because Marvin has taken years to solve a problem which really should have been solved very, very much sooner. The great bonus here is that there's potentially a great deal of money that can be earned by charging people for going in this area. The principal thing is to stop the wrong vehicles going into this area, then to charge people, make use of that money to mitigate the problems that have been caused to people who are living in that area with the wrong sort of cars, or that need to visit that area with the wrong sort of cars.
The only thing is,
who are deprived.
We've got a problem here. Is that it isn't clear that the modern diesels are actually even as polluting as petrol cars.
Well, look, we're probably going to be mincing around this sort of science for a very long time. The fact is that we know vehicles generally are not good for air quality in certain parts of well, everywhere, but certainly not in certain parts of the centre of Bristol. And we should be doing our best to sort out all vehicles, and that means, I'm afraid, taxis as well, which one of these options completely does not include. 40% of the air pollution in these areas comes from private cars. That doesn't say diesels or petrol, it says private cars.
Okay.
One of the options doesn't tackle that.
Okay, we better make it clear what the two options are that we're supposed to be being consulted on, even though there's in the background the clean air plans, we're told in the Bristol Post, lack proper information about them. The two options are, one, to charge buses, taxis, vans and HGVs to drive in the city, and the other is to ban all diesel vehicles between 7 and 3 p.m. So they've come up with two options, Martin, but the idea of charging taxis, well, the taxis are actually public transport, buses are public transport, HGVs I can understand, but it seems that part of the consultation is about penalising public transport, which just seems counterproductive.
Well, that's the first I've heard of it. I mean, it seems pretty odd to me that you should try and, you know, we want people to use buses, and therefore, you know, that just seems silly to me. The problem with all of these things is the path dependency. We decisions made decades ago to have a motorised economy. You know, the public transport. We used to have trams in Bristol, and they were just taken away, and they would have been there. The tram lines would have been there if they hadn't been stripped out. And happening in Eastern Europe.
One of them still sticking out of the ground in St Mary Redcliffe Churchyard.
A tram line, yeah.
Yeah, just only a little bit, though. I don't think you could run.
The trams were quite suddenly taken away.
Over the country, yeah.
Well,
it wasn't just here.
But particularly on one night in, I believe, 1941. Mm. So that made trams unworkable in Bristol at that time. They could have been brought back. And when we tried to put the Metrobus system in Bristol, when it was our turn to actually hold that particular very hot topic, we actually stopped the process for 4 or 5 months to go back and review to see if it was possible to make it work with light trams, it was twice as expensive.
Transport in Bristol never seems to work, public transport, for whatever reason. Anyway, diesels, another thing to say about diesels is they're much safer when it comes to crashes, because the fuel is much less flammable. Diesel flashpoint,
Tony,
is...
the issue here is clean air. We're not talking about crashes, we're not talking about what the percentile difference is between petrol and diesel or whatever. We have to sort this problem out, and that means we have to tackle something innovatively rather than just picking her out. And that's what these two options are. And one of the reasons we've gone for this rather senseless 8-hour option as the second option is because the legal department of Bristol City Council says that the report that it says about all the advantages of the 24-hour ban is actually not allowed legally in the country.
It sounds like a back of the envelope job.
This is something which has been done in an amazing rush because Marvin could not sort it out within the prescribed time last year, like most other cities did.
Okay, what would you do? Because Marvin's made the very important point, in fact, that they don't want this to impact just the poorer people.
I absolutely accept that, but the point I made right at the beginning is that option one, and any option which will stop vehicles coming into those areas, actually generates a vast amount of money. It doesn't say in the report, amazingly, although people are asking to be consulted upon it, it doesn't say where that money is. But elsewhere, it says that money might be anything as between 50 and 200 million quid. Now, that can do an awful lot of mitigation for people that are going to have a problem because they've got the wrong sort of vehicle where they live. And remember, if the point is being made that it's poor people who are most disadvantaged here, they are also those people living in those areas who are suffering the bad air.
Martin, fact check. This is, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page, and I think maybe some of the people at the City Council should have a look. Are diesel cars really more polluting than petrol cars? This is by Paul Niewelunner. This is May last year that he did this article. He argues, and this is a so-called unbiased scientific report, that the modern diesel cars are actually less polluting than petrol cars because of the very they've got these amazing high tech that if something goes wrong with your filter, you're going to have to pay probably £2,000 to get it replaced. But these diesel particulate filters actually enable modern diesels since around about 2010 or so to be less polluting than petrol cars. And I'll put a link up to this if people don't believe me. Let's have a look at this, because it seems to me that what they've done with the new diesels is mitigates against any reason to ban these new vehicles.
Yeah, but I mean, as Anthony said, it's not just a question of diesel versus petrol. The question is, there's too many cars, full stop.
Absolutely.
And we've got to find a way to get people...
What would you do?
Well, I think that you can't... A part of the problem we've got is that you can't solve this at a local level very easily.
Well, listen, quite a lot of this pollution coming, say, from the M5? People going from Cardiff to London
The M4? You've got to have an overall strategy nationally, at minimum, The idea that the local councils don't actually have a lot of power to do anything very much, and then the things that they think that they could do something about, something like this, they then get a terrible reputation for not doing anything about it.
But the governments have dropped this into the laps of local councils, and what's more, they're saying you must come up with a solution which will work fastest. And that's their criteria.
At the same time, Anthony, they're taking money away from local councils to do the sorts of work that's needed.
Of course they are. Who said that central government made any sense?
Fears over lack of transparency after councillor suggests there are secretive boards. Now, the councillor concerned is Jeff Gollop from the Conservative group here in Bristol, and members are concerned about the motives of our unelected people who sit on the boards.
And I was quoted in the same article.
Yes, Anthony, which is why I phoned you up this week and tried to get you in, because this is the sort of thing. I mean, we were told, weren't we, that when they first talked about having a mayor here in Bristol, some people warned of a dictatorship. That is the sort of thing that seems to be going on here, because whereas traditionally we've had all sorts of committees, transport and all sorts of business being sorted out by councillors in public with minuted meetings and everything that are available, now it seems we're going in the opposite direction. Secret boards where the mayor just appoints his mates or whoever he feels like appointing, or maybe someone else is doing the appointing and telling him, put this guy on the board. So how is this process working, and what boards have been set up? And it's under the One City initiative, I believe.
It is. It's called the One City Plan, which was, according to the mayor, was completely of his making. He may be interested to know that George Ferguson before him, us before George Ferguson, and the Labour Party before us all had these sorts of arrangements with the big players in the city. The difference is that those were public, they were brought in front of scrutiny, they were discussed, everybody knew what was going on. That is no longer the case. These are meetings that from which the public and councillors are excluded. I've actually got an email saying you're not invited, you can't attend these meetings. We've had a case of a councillor being thrown out of a meeting that they attended. I was politely told that I was not a member of a working group, that I went along to try and give my some of my experience of being a previous cabinet member for that subject to them. And but the officers were incredibly polite and said, I'm sorry, you're not part of this group, so therefore you can't stay. And we should be encouraging people to coalesce and get behind these things, because in principle, what Marvin's trying to do is what all of those other administrations have been trying to do as well, trying to solve problems holistically. The difference is that Marvin is doing it secretly and under control, and that's something, as a Liberal Democrat, I feel very strongly about. We're losing scrutiny in this city. We're losing the resources to perform scrutiny and look at things and be able to offer ideas and be able to look very, very very carefully at what's being done in terms of policy, that is no longer very easy to do. And if it's also very secretive, as indeed are the companies, all the arm's-length companies which have now been set up are very difficult for councillors to get to and find out the information on, because a lot of that is commercially sensitive and exempt. So it's very difficult for us to find out anything about anything.
This is really worrying, Martin. 6 theme boards have been set up under the One City Plan, the local authority-led vision. This is Marvin-led vision, really. I don't think it's fair to say everybody's vision. For Bristol in 2050, 2 of the already 4 already in existence, statutory body, the Health and Wellbeing Board and Bristol Homes Board, comprise city councillors and interest groups such as housing tenants, health chiefs and patient representatives, and they do hold public meetings, apparently, with a forum for residents to submit questions and statements, we're told. What about that, Anthony? If they're holding public meetings, then surely there's not a problem, is
there? The Housing Management Board, which is a meeting for tenants, there are public meetings, but what they tend to be about is being told what's been done and asked to make the right noises.
Told what's been done at secret meetings.
That's what happens with councillors. Many of our scrutiny meetings and many of our briefings are simply being told what's been done, and very often when we try to get the papers in enough time to be able to make some input into them, like for example the carbon neutrality report, I've served on a working group there for some time, a cross-party working group which I got Marvin to agree to, and the very first thing Marvin said was, you're just going to use this as a stick to beat me with. In fact, there was an amazing amount of cooperation between all 4 parties, despite the fact that officers were expecting, even looking out for the differences. The important thing was we made sure we ironed out those very few differences, and there were differences of priorities, not differences of principle. We got all of that sorted out, gave a very strong recommendation to Marvin to go through with this, and said, out of courtesy, could we please see his report before it went out, so we could make sure that there were any comments, any helpful comments we could make. We were not allowed to see that report, despite the fact that we put an awful lot of work into making sure that it what was in it.
The other 2 committees, Martin, the Learning City Partnership, which of course brings together all sorts of schools, academies,
and skills,
and training, and also the Bristol Transport Board. So this is also major things that affect everybody in the city. They all meet behind closed doors.
They do.
Well, I mean, the conception behind having executive mayors like this, the Tories basically decided that's what they wanted. And, you know, there was some dispute. I mean,
we voted for it.
I think it was about 14% of the electorate turned out to vote for it. So in actual fact, and many people were astounded that on the back of that, we ended up with this system. And it's almost like ancient history now. Do you remember the Cameron government when it first came to power, with its various stuff on the back of an envelope? Mayors. They have mayors in America. So we're going to have mayors. Ken Livingstone never believed in directly elected mayors in London. He was the leader of the Labour group on the GLC, and he only stood as a mayor and won and then lost to Boris Johnson because that's the system that was put in place. But he's always consistently said, I don't believe in mayors. And do you know what? I agree with him. I don't believe in mayors.
So this whole idea of scrutiny, Anthony, surely it's more important if you've only got one person making massive decisions with millions of pounds of public money.
And of course it is. And when we were told about this prospect of having the mayoral system in Bristol, we had a professor came down and gave us several lectures and all the rest of it, and he said it'll be no different at all to us from having a leader of the council. In those days, of course, it was Barbara Jank who led the council. No difference at all in terms of powers and everything else. Everything will just be called a mayor. And we said right from the outset, of course that isn't so. Of course that's wrong. George took quite a few extra powers immediately, and Marvin's taken even more. And we no longer have even a pretense of having a rainbow cabinet. And Marvin is completely, you know, stitching this up. Not, I'm not saying as an individual, but as a bag holder, as a totem holder for the mayoralty. The Lib Dems have always been against this. We are putting up a candidate for the mayor elections in 2020, which absolutely says that the first opportunity we will get rid of that role. So the person who's standing, Mary Page, is going to be campaigning on getting rid of the role for which she hopes, and I hope too, she's going to be elected.
The other thing, of course, is this means it's impossible for the press to scrutinise. If people like yourself, Anthony, are not looking at, able to look at these things, we don't get any public
debate.
Much
more important than that, the public are not being given the opportunity to see what's being done
in their
name.
Well, that's what I mean. When I say the press, I mean that it doesn't get out to the public.
The public, yeah. And I try and do my job on their behalf. But the fact is the public are even more disadvantaged than I am as a councillor.
It does seem as if the whole warnings about Bristol becoming a dictatorship are happening, are unfolding before our eyes.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm nodding here.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I voted for Marvin for mayor. Of course, one of the only advantages of the mayoral setup is you've got a transferable vote. Because, of course, what used to happen is, you know, you got first past the post where people end up being councillors on less than 50% of the vote. So, on principle, and I don't actually think that local government is that important in the big scheme of things. But I agree virtually with everything Anthony said. The mayoral system is inevitably going to... It's basically modelled on that of a private company. He's a CEO. He's not a political figure, effectively.
And yes, but we're not little pieces on a conveyor belt,
exactly,
are we?
And that's the whole idea. That we're going to get things done. You know, this is the idea. If we have mayors, they're going to be like US mayors, and they will be, you know, they'll be recognisable characters, and they will get things done and so on. Now, the most successful council leader in Britain at one stage, I would suggest, was Ken Livingstone, and he didn't do it by being a directly elected mayor, and he was answerable to the Labour group. And then one of the problems with Marvin now, he's not answerable to the Labour group. The Labour group can't stop him if he wants to do something. For example, over the what was going to happen with the arena, then he can just override
it. I mean, do you find that Labour members that sit on committees with you, Anthony, do you find that they are much more in touch with Marvin than you?
I sometimes speak to Labour councillors, and I'm not going to name anybody, and I ask them, what's going on? Because I haven't heard anything about this, and the answer usually is, we don't know either, we're not told. The fact is, Marvin's got everyone in a fog about this, and it's a problem. Coming back to what Martin just said, there are two ways of being a leader. One is to completely ignore everybody else and just do what you blooming well want to do. And the other way, far more potent, far more realistic and innovative, is to engage people, everybody, in what you're doing and make sure that the decisions you come out with are much more robust. That's why we set up the neighbourhood partnerships, bottom-down stuff. That's how decisions are made. That works its way into the system and informs it. You don't do things properly by ignoring everybody else and keeping everyone in the dark. That's just lack of trust, it's lack of confidence, it's lack of belief in yourself and what you're trying to achieve. Put it out there, get people to comment on it, and it gets better as a result.
Well, I've got a couple of little bugs, Anthony, that you can put on the wall just before you go into the meeting, or just before they go into the meeting, and you can find out what's happening that way. So maybe that's what we need to do.
I couldn't possibly comment.
In principle, a mayor, the mayor system is designed for the mayor to be a bulldozer. Yeah. That was the original conception of it. So all that Marvin is doing what the Tories originally conceived that these mayors were supposed to do. I don't agree with it, but he's
going to be. It looks like the Labour candidate again next time, doesn't it? Amazingly,
He's the sitting candidate. Martin, he's unlikely to be decent.
Martin, you will know that the first concept of this came out at the very end of the Labour government. I'm not trying to make.
No, I know.
Point,
well, it's just
it's, they're both in it together.
Well, it's a neoliberal conception. It's basically, as I say, it's treating the local council as if it was a private company, and it isn't a private company. It's not. It's conceptually
more,
different.
It feels
thing.
More like Imperial Rome at times, I can tell you.
Okay. First bus, we were talking about transport a bit already, but apparently the first bus has been put up for sale. That is, the company owns it, including the Great Western Railway. And then there was a story saying Labour wants to help Mayor Marvin Rees to set up a Bristol-run bus company. But then suddenly I read American hedge fund has launched a takeover bid for Bristol's first bus and train services. So what do we know about? I mean, do you know anything about this?
As I understand it, the intention from the from First Group was to hive off First Bus and keep the rest. It was a way of trying to sort out the problems of First Bus, but I'm not the best person informed on this. There is another way of doing this. Whatever the private companies want to end up with, and whoever they want to eat each other up to try and take this over, that we can achieve what we want and what we need to achieve in Bristol by franchising the buses, by actually laying down the conditions under which they operate for fares and timetables and routes. That would be a way of making sure that the companies will do what we want within a company structure. If we try and buy up the company, it will cost a huge amount of money and we'll achieve very little more than we would with franchising.
Well, we had a Conservative leadership debate this week on the BBC, 8 o'clock on, was it Wednesday? I think it was. And one of the points that came up was, will whoever takes over as Conservative leader actually be able to leave the European Union on or by the 31st of October? And so here's the answer of the two winners of that, at which the Conservatives are now starting the process of voting on, the members, that is. That is to say, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt. So let's hear what they had to say.
We must come out on the 31st of October, because otherwise I'm afraid we face a catastrophic loss of confidence in politics. We've already kicked the can down the road twice, and I think the British people are getting thoroughly fed up. Whether you voted remain or leave, the people were asked a question, they returned a verdict, the politicians said that they were going to honour that verdict. 3 years later, we have still failed to leave. And unless we do it, unless we get out on October the 31st, I think that we will all start to pay a really, really serious price. Our party, Lee, the party that you used to support, is now on 17 points in the polls. The Labour Party isn't doing much better. Politicians need to take their responsibilities and act maturely and soberly in the interests of democracy and of the electorate and get this thing done.
It's a very important question. If I got to the 31st of October and there was no prospect of a deal that can get us out of the EU, then I would be out. I'd leave without a deal. If there was a prospect, if we were nearly there, then I would take a bit longer, because the Conservative Party is the party of business, we're the part of the union, we're the party of hope, and I would want to avoid the disruption of no deal, the risk of a general election that could let in Jeremy Corbyn. But we have to resolve this, and we have to resolve this quickly, because this is about trust of the British people in people like us, the politicians, whether we actually do what we're told or whether we impose our will, and we mustn't let them down.
Well, I think you could probably say that Jeremy Hunt was a little bit softer on whether we could get out on the 31st of October or not, but neither of them actually committed to it, Anthony, did they?
Well, that's their problem, isn't it? They're both they're coming from the position of wanting to be leader of their party. I think they're not thinking about the future of this country enough, and I think that's flavoured this debate we've had for the last 3 years. There's been too many people trying to make sure that their party or their particular point of view was protected, rather than thinking about the long-term future of this country. So much has changed in the last 3 years that it is absolutely nonsensical to take this any further without having people reappraise the situation with the information we now have that we never had before. There are many things which have been the
principal debating points over the last 12, 15 months, which were never mentioned in the original referendum time.
Martin.
It is fatuous to say that that was a result that we should actually follow without reappraising it.
Martin, neither of them actually saying, yes, they will definitely get out by the 31st of October, although Boris seemed to be a little bit more stronger that he probably would. Actually, what Jeremy Hunt said, he says, if there's no prospect of a deal, well, I mean, you could argue that there's always a prospect of a deal, so that's a very, very, definitely, he's not saying, I'm coming out on the 31st. But anyway, what do you make of this debate and the possibility of one or other of these two taking over after Theresa May?
Well, you've got to remember that this is a debate in a contest which is going to be run inside the Conservative Party, so they're trying to appeal to the grassroots of the Conservative Party. And we pretty much know a lot of them voted Brexit Party. In fact, in the Labour Party, they wouldn't be allowed to vote in an internal election having voted for somebody else. But let's just put that aside. So you've got to, they're talking to themselves. You know, it's like watching a private quarrel. The fundamentals are that there is no majority for a no deal Brexit in this Parliament. And if they try and force it through, Rory Stewart, Philip Hammond, the others in the Tory party who said, well, we'll vote a no-confidence vote against the government to force a general election. And I think even the Tories are accepting now that if they have Johnson, which seems what they're going to go for, they're basically choosing their leader for a general election.
We did discuss last week a little bit this whole idea of proroguing Parliament, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions too.
Anna Soubry!
Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister is keen to secure a legacy of acting in the country's very best interests. So will she commit to introducing legislation that will guarantee that this House sits in September and in October so that in the event of a no-deal Brexit, all options are available to this Parliament, including revoking Article 50?
The dates for recess and times for sitting for this House will be published to this House in due course.
Sorry, I'll if you want me to comment on what's just been said, I think this is just moving the deck chairs, quite honestly. We are in a situation where people are saying that the bad side of everything is a no-deal Brexit. Do people honestly believe that the deal, the only deal that's out there, the Theresa May deal, is particularly better than a no-deal Brexit? I don't think so. I think it's still a very poor deal, which is why no one's actually voted significant numbers for it. We're talking about the devil and the deep blue sea, but we're only actually using the code word of no-deal Brexit to try and explain what it's going to be like under any poor deal that comes out of this situation.
Martin, the whole idea here is to shut down Parliament. That's what Theresa May has just said.
Yeah.
Basically, she said, well, we reserve that option.
Well, I mean, Vernon Bugdenor, who's a sort of political scientist, he said, well, if you look at the legal position, they possibly can get away with it, but politically, it'd be very, very difficult. Rory Stewart has already said, we will convene Parliament in Westminster's Methodist Central Hall. So you can have Boris Johnson can prorogue Parliament, but Parliament will reconvene. And of course, this is constitutional crisis of the highest order. And of course, we've got the Irish saying we want a united Ireland. We've got the Scots saying we're going to leave the United Kingdom. And the Welsh Parliament has already made its position clear it wants a second referendum. So we're looking at the breakup of Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, the FYU, the former Soviet Union, the FSU. We're going to be the FUK.
Okay. Democracy and all this. We were talking about earlier.
Indeed.
That's gone down the. That could go down the pan.
We've never had
it's funny
a properly
because
a properly
it's going down the pan
in
here in Bristol simultaneously.
I was referring to what we said earlier
quite,
as well.
Quite.
This
nervous.
Is a very, very worrying situation. And this country has to think about its democratic future. It's about our ability to move forward as a country. And I think what we're proposing now on these absurd suggestions is to find some way to get us through a monstrous situation are going to leave us with that seriously damaged, which allows the opportunity for the renegades to
Can
come
you
in.
See a kind of Arab Spring type situation erupting here, Anthony, if they try and shut down Parliament?
Well, that's something I frankly don't want to countenance.
Okay.
It's too worrying.
One of the people mentioned there, thanks very much for joining us, by the way. I know you've got a dash now, but Anthony, but one of the people mentioned there is Rory Stewart, and he was in the, apparently in MI6, Martin. What would you know about this? Because he says he wasn't, and though, but he would have to say that. Wouldn't he?
He would say that, wouldn't he? That's all I can say about that.
But is it okay to lie and say I wasn't in MI6 wasn't?
Listen, if you're in that world, Tony, you're either a paid officer of MI6, or you could be what's called an agent of influence. You just basically schmooze with them, and they schmooze with you and tell you things that they'd like you to do, and you go, yes, I can help you.
Anyway, he's denied having anything to do with MI6, but I tracked down, with a little bit of help, a chap who'd been very, very close to Rory Stewart, and his name's Stephen Landrigan. In fact, he lived right next door to him in Kabul, and he wasn't very impressed.
The quick history is that when it was built, it was out in the country.
This is a fort where they both lived, just outside Kabul.
It was about 4 or 5 miles away. This was out of a place where it was good hunting. There was wetlands nearby. And the king at the time, Abdurrahman, built himself a palace at the top of a hill, and this, where the Kali Nurbaja was built, down below it, and his wazir lived there.
Okay, so how old is the place?
1880. About 1880 is what architectural historians generally accept.
And it was a kind of quadrangle with various people, aid workers, etc., living there. What did Rory do? Because I understand he kind of built on it. Which is a bit peculiar, since he's renting the property. He then also spent money improving the place. What did he do?
We all put in our own lighting and, in some cases, water and so on like that. You had to do it. This place was a mud brick fort, 2 or 3 stories high and very, very elegant and very much of another age, but not a place for modern living. So, but what Rory did was he then built like a triumphal arch attached to the front of the main entrance into the courtyard. He built a gatehouse right out of Disney at the edge of the property that everybody had to come through. He built a kiln for his pottery work, so it was never really used in a great amount because most of the pottery was done, as I say, a half hour north. And then there was a cement brick house on the property that belonged to a relative of the woman who claimed to own the fort. And so without contacting those people, he doubled the size of the house, clad it in mud bricks, and made it look very, very old. It's actually quite nice. I mean, I have to say one thing about Turquoise Mountain. They did a good job. And then when the family found out what was happening to their house, they raised noise, and I think Rory paid them quite a bit. So what I'm saying, the overall picture is Rory spent a lot of money, donor money, on aggrandizing his position by building a viceroy-style mansion in Kabul, which was perfect for the photo ops, which was good because every glossy magazine in Britain seemed to be coming through there on a regular basis to photograph Rory in situ. Rory does everything through third parties. Rory did not go up to these people and say, you have to leave. But he engineered a situation where other people went and did that, and Rory ultimately was the beneficiary. In both cases, these were very impoverished Hazara Afghan families who lived just adjacent to our main courtyard. Rory wanted their territory, because as his staff increased, he needed more place to put people. In fact, one time we were walking in front of the rooms I had, we were up on the second level overlooking one of these families, and he says, how do we know for sure that Mabuba owns this? Mabuba is the widow of the man who had owned the place. And I said, well, you know, you need to find out. But Roy, he said, I must have that land. But there were people down there. They were tending their cow. They were drawing water from the well, which took 42 pulls on the rope. It was a family, and Rory didn't see them. He wanted that land, and that's all there was to it. Rory's sense of entitlement was second to none, and it was very, very evident in that. And in almost everything else he did, there was no consequences to what he said or did, because it was Rory. He could do what he wanted. I was in the fort from about 2005 to 2008. Rory came in I think it was May of 2006. I think that was it. And then I left. He was still there when I left. So we overlapped about 2.5 years.
And what's your memory of him as a person?
I thought of him as a cross between Peter Pan and Uriah Heep. This is a man who was flitting around, feeling very self-important at all times, always engaged in self-mythologizing. But a man who was not, a man who would not listen. He loved an audience, but he was not a listener. And he was always right, and he was always grand, and just the kind of person you run away from.
I mean, this is a very important time for Afghanistan. I would have thought there would have been some sort of press coverage of Rory, his activities there. Was there any? Was there any interest?
Oh, what? Every week he had somebody coming out. He obviously had a PR firm. Somebody has suggested that it's Bell Pottinger, the discredited firm. I don't know that. But yes, there was, you name it, particularly the glossy magazines, not just British, it was the American. Smithsonian was out. Time got him to write some pieces. Vanity Fair, I don't know if it was, I shouldn't say that, I don't know that, but several others. There were dozens of them. What was most amazing about it, Tony, was that every article seemed to follow the same format. It was almost as if somebody had given the writers points. These need to be covered. I don't know if that happened, but that you couldn't read these, many, many dozens of articles without wondering who's behind this. It was even true, not just the glossies. I mean, there was some of the British newspapers. I don't want to bother mentioning names, but there was some of the articles that we read followed just right along the line. And the worst thing was every single one of them completely promoted Rory's bio as he would print it in the front of the books that he published, but it's bogus. And nobody checked it. And
What was bogus about his biography?
Well, I mean, this is nothing I have personal connection. I personally have not investigated it, but Ian Parker of The New Yorker did so in 2015 and found that Rory's claim to work have been part of the Black Watch Regiment was apparently some summer program for young people. That is much vaunted time as a tutor to the princes Harry and William was only for 2 weeks one summer. I'm not sure if Ian Parker did this, but a man named Craig Murray, who was once British ambassador to neighboring Uzbekistan, claimed that Rory was MI6. I don't know that myself. And I'm trying to think what's the other one. Anyway, it was that kind of thing. It was always Rory promoting himself, but nobody ever checked him. Nobody checked the facts. Nobody asked any hard questions of Rory. That drove me crazy.
Okay. Do you think you'd make a good prime minister?
Well, if Britain wants to have the Trump experience, they should vote for him. But this is a man who is not able to speak the truth. He's about promoting his image, his ambitions. He's not completely stupid. I'm sure he'd do some things right. But would I vote for him? No. I'm not in one party or the other in terms of British politics, but I would not want a man quite so dishonest at the top of my country.
He's also denied ever being involved in MI6, but some have said that actually if you are involved in MI6, that was what you have to say.
That may well be. I don't have a clue. I don't know anything about MI6.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you don't have to deny it. You know, you can just leave it in a way that creates the perfect mystique, doesn't it? If you neither confirm nor deny.
Rory was pretty good at that and other things. If Rory didn't want to discuss something, he would turn around and walk away. And that happened to me a couple of times. It happened to other people. I remember there was one, it was told to me by a man from Nepal. Rory had talked about having walked across Asia and part of Nepal, and the Nepali gentleman said he'd love to know more about the route that Rory took because it was virtually impossible for a person to have walked across it. And this was at the Asia Foundation at a dinner reception, and Rory didn't answer. He just turned around and walked away. That's our Rory. So, never apologize, never explain.
Okay, Stephen, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, all the best.
So that's Stephen Landrigan, who lived next door to Rory Stewart for a couple of years in Kabul, Martin. It sounds to me like he's kind of made up a mythological version of himself, and also the mass media have helped actually puff that up without asking questions.
Well, in many ways, he's a self-publicist in the way that political figures often are. There's nothing there that surprises me about
him. I mean, from what we've just heard there... I mean, for example, using donor money to build himself a little palace as a backdrop for media shots doesn't sound like a very good development secretary, even. international development secretary.
Listen, he's basically someone who has made a big deal out of how well connected he is in the right circles. You know, he knows Princes William and Harry, etc., etc. So that's what he is.
Thanks to our guest, former leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, that's Councillor Cottam Anthony Negus. Join me after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we spread our wings around the world.